Jack's Mansell's speech was really quite important because it follows up with from a conversation that I had last week with Gavin McFadden from the Australian Conservation Foundation around the safeguard mechanism brokered by the Greens with Labor. It's all terribly important because, you know, we're in a climate emergency. But this is what Jack had to talk about. But it was a talk that was entitled NGOs Getting Paid to Preserve the System. It's not the entire talk. You'll be able to get more of the talk from Socialist Alternatives webpage when they put up all the stuff from the Marxist conference. But let's start off with what I can share this morning.
Foundation, which is an environmental NGO at which he held a life membership for his role in the Franklin River Dam campaign in the 80s. And the issue at stake was the ACF's call to urgently pass the Albanese government safeguard mechanism legislation, which is a revived Abbott-era policy that includes, you know, dodgy carbon offset accounting, has no impact on export emissions, and allows companies to increase emissions so long as they also increase production as well. For supporting the legislation, Bob Brown attacked the ACF as well as the Climate Council, another NGO, as being part of what he said was a Labour-backed lobby to have the Greens vilified for wanting more action against the climate. And notwithstanding the fact that the Greens have now also voted in favour of the legislation, this was the final straw for Bob Brown, who had made similar criticisms of Labour's signature climate bill a few months back. So in response to what Bob Brown said, ACF Chief Kelly O'Shaughnessy wheeled out a line that is probably familiar to climate activists, that the safeguard mechanism is a start, not an end, to climate policy in Australia. No details required, but it is a start, just trust her. It's a line that I think could be added to the pantheon of climate pragmatist preachings that includes the adage, don't make the perfect the enemy of the good, regardless of whether something is good or not, actually. And obviously Bob Brown is not some radical calling for the end of capitalism. He spent 3 years as the Greens leader, propping up a quite right-wing Gillard Rudd government. And his own NGO, the Bob Brown Foundation, organises a mixture of lobbying, court challenges and direct action around individual projects. But he's definitely right about this. I think the stance that the ACF took in support of Labor's bill isn't an anomaly, but it's actually one that was shared by virtually every single climate NGO in Australia. Similar kind of statements that combine some mild criticism, but also emphasising the supposed reforms and how much of a victory they are, virtually universal in the contemporary climate scene. And I think if you were to take the words and tone of the ACF about the safeguard mechanism, and the Greens for that matter, at face value, you'd be forgiven for thinking that we're moving in the right direction on the environment, if a little slowly, and that all the government needs is a little nudge to do the right thing and usher in the action that we need. But unfortunately, exactly the opposite is true. So year-on-year global carbon emissions are growing. Australia's coal and gas exporters are raking in record profits. So in 2021-22, the supposedly dying fossil fuel industry in Australia, you always hear that, the fossil fuel industry is dying. Why don't we just go to renewables instead? They made windfall profits, so extra profits of $85 billion. Yeah. And Australia leads the list now of both coal and liquid natural gas exports globally. The Albanese government, which came to power promising the end of the climate wars, whatever that actually means, has approved 116 new fossil fuel projects, including some that even Scott Morrison had banned. I think that situation of an expanding fossil fuel industry is no accident, but is the hallmark of a capitalist system addicted to profits. And that is a system that the ALP is committed to serving. And I think the sort of disjunct between this softly positive rhetoric of the environmental NGO world and the reality of the climate crisis is actually symptomatic of a broader political problem that they have, and that's the thing that I want to kind of unpack. I think what it expresses is the NGO logic of venerating compromise and working with, not against, the very institutions that are responsible for these crimes. So rather than aiming to change the world through fighting against the system, Instead, NGOs see changes coming through a mixture of lobbying, legal challenges, sometimes protests, divestment, awareness raising that aim to compel and convince the powers that be to act in the interests of the planet. I think it's worth saying, the scale of the climate crisis can make this sort of achievable change argument seem quite alluring. I think something or the illusion of something can feel much better than nothing, can feel much better than the kind of doomerism that predominates our generation. So I think for a lot of young people, you know, an NGO with an office, a permanent staff, slick branding, all the rest of it, can seem like a much more legitimate and realistic way of making change than being a fringe radical. But I think the question is, can they make the change that we actually need? And what are the consequences of constantly trying to find compromise and space in the halls of power to achieve climate action? I think what you have to start with is a realistic appraisal of what it will take to deal with the climate crisis and how we can go about doing that. So just to kind of recap some of the key socialist arguments that underpin this analysis, I want to go through them. Firstly, that capitalism and the state cannot solve the climate crisis because it would mean upending the sanctity of the profit motive. Secondly, that greenwashing, so looking like you're doing something to avoid actually doing something, is the new dominant strategy of the ruling class, of which the Australian Labor Party epitomises. That genuine climate justice will require confrontation with the ruling class and the profit motive through mass disruptive action and, at the end of the day, through revolution. And that fourth, that the role of radicals in this situation should be to clarify all of those things, not constantly obscure the lines of whose side we're on, who's our friend, who's our enemy, and everything in between. So what are environmental NGOs? It's a big question, it's contested. I think defined broadly, environmental NGOs are organisations with the stated aim of stopping catastrophic climate change, the aim in the more immediate term to get better outcomes in environmental policy. I think organisationally, they tend to take the form of bureaucracies with full-time staff, and internal governance structures that are often in line with official charity or registered organisation status. I think sometimes they can have more democratic internal spaces, particularly at the lower campaign levels, but it's also worth saying that most of the campaigns that NGOs run are actually designed by professional NGO people and strategists according to an existing worldview, and then are exported out to various different places where people can join in. So that was true of the Stop Adani campaign, something that I was a part of, in Sydney. Unlike political parties, NGOs don't try and stand in elections or attempt to form some kind of cohesive alternative political pole of attraction to the status quo. I think what they try and do is influence the existing political parties to be better. They also don't have a systematic approach to organising any particular social layer, definitely not working class people, in any antagonism to the ruling class, in the way that even a trade union might, despite the limitations of that model as well. So I think, yeah, NGOs see their role as achieving change through compelling powerful institutions to act in a more environmentally friendly way, whether that's trying to convince a bank to divest from fossil fuels or to convince the government to adopt more progressive policies. And I think it can lead to a contradiction where NGOs can be both critical of and committed to working with those powerful institutions. And to do that, they embrace a mixture of tactics. So that can include, like I've said, protest and direct action. But I think more commonly encompasses divestment of super or banks, lobbying, sending emails to MPs, attending summits, publishing reports, handing out election scorecards where the Greens and Labor look like they're both pretty good, and so on. And I think to NGOs, none of these tactics take particular political priority over the other because they're all seen as useful ways of influencing power. I think another common strategy of environmental NGOs that can be a bit more difficult to see the problem with is just forming widespread civil society partnerships with businesses, trade unions, political groups, think tanks, all sorts of other institutions and groups around a vague need to act on the climate crisis. And I think from this you can say that their politics are liberal because they don't make organisational, political or strategic distinctions based on class and class power, but rather on the basis of ideas more commonly presented as values. And to try and understand the way that NGOs look to power, protest, these sorts of things, I spent some time looking through the resources section of their websites. And I think this quote from School Strike for Climate Handbook, obviously School Strike being one of the more activist-facing NGOs, gives you a sense of how even the more activist-based NGOs accept the need to get the rich and powerful on board rather than to fight against them. So I'll quote, "Businesses, unions, organisations and partner groups have power in your community. They vote in elections, they hold relationships with powerful people, and they have skills, money and resources that you could use." Now, I don't think any Marxist is going to disagree that businesses have power in our community. I just think that businesses and the powerful people that they hold relationships with, and you can throw in the major political parties to that as well, are fundamentally committed to the system of profit-making that is causing the climate crisis in the first place. I think whether you appeal to them or whether you fight against them are two radically different approaches to making social change. And so I think, to the extent that NGOs do engage in activism, which they do, it's either around individual polluting projects where they say, we're going to make this our cause and we're going to, you know, do a bunch of disruption to that, you know, all well and good, or it aims to bolster the lobbying of that NGO. So you have this big demonstration where you can show, look how many people agree with us. And I think the school strike campaign, which was a great improvement on the sort of focus on individual consumption that had dominated mainstream environmentalism, unfortunately suffered this orientation towards lobbying. And in their case, it was towards the ALP, a party which, you know, despite publicly and repeatedly proclaiming their support for the expansion of the fossil fuel industry, enjoys the gloss of being a lesser evil. So I'm old enough to remember standing in Sydney Town Hall Square with tens of thousands of other young people being asked from the front of the rally to get my phone out to text Bill Shorten's office, "Bill, will you be our climate saviour?" And today, yeah, I know, he decided not to respond to us, despite our very morally compelling protest. But I think, you know, today, when the school strike movement has waned quite a lot, rather than attempting to sort of rebuild or escalate that level of mass participation, SS4C largely organises smaller actions that fit into the electoral cycle. So there was a few around the last federal election in Sydney, meeting up with politicians and so on. And I think now that we have a Labor government, there's actually a notable lack of the sort of combative rhetoric that they used to take towards the fossil dinosaur Scott Morrison, despite the fact that practically the two parties are indistinguishable on any policy points around climate change. It's during the bushfire crisis at the end of 2019 and early 2020. So you've got this year of very positive escalating actions around the climate that not only include mass rallies, but also an increasing number of people who want to throw themselves in the way, stop the fossil fuel industry by putting themselves on the line, you know, the blockade of IMARC being one, the Extinction Rebellion meetings, which every single week in Sydney we had like 50 or 100 new people turning up wanting to get involved in militant climate action. So amidst that situation, the fires broke out. And there was absolutely simmering mass anger. I remember going to the bank and the bank teller being like, "What the fuck is going on?" Like, when do you have that feeling when normality breaks down in such a way that even a bank teller who's, you know, usually told you got to put your uniform on nice, put your tie up like that and be very sensible, they're the ones saying, "What is going on?" To a random punter on the street. This mass anger. And the NGOs were absolutely nowhere to be seen. They didn't try and organise a single action around the crisis. And it came down to a small group of socialists in Sydney. I remember the conversation we were having on the street in King Street in Newtown, being like, "What the hell is going on? Why has nobody called anything?" So we called something and tens of thousands of people showed up. And I think, you know, considering the enormously greater mobilising capacity of the NGO scene, it was like an abdication of their responsibility to the moment that they were in, that they didn't try and call anything. And a bunch of it was because they would have been criticised in the media, like socialists were in Victoria, for, you know, taking services, emergency services away from the front lines of the fire. And they did not want to stand up to that. They did not want to damage their respectability because in their eyes, the respectability of the movement is the thing that makes it useful at lobbying the government, not its militancy and its mass character.
You're with Annie on Solidarity Breakfast and we're listening to Jack Mansell at the Marxist Conference. He was giving a talk called NGOs Getting Paid to Preserve the System. This is only excerpts from that talk, but this is the last part.
All of these things that I've kind of referenced, I want to go through some examples of how this plays out, exercise conservatising pressures on environmental NGOs, regardless of their starting point. And greenwashing, so the massively accelerating ruling class strategy, which in the last 5 years even has just become hegemonic, is gelling perfectly with the whole strategy and approach that NGOs have. So unlike in the days of climate denialism, there's now this huge maze of negotiating, of compromise, of consultation that's presented by the ruling class as a path to action, and the NGO world is invited to take their rightful place at the table. You know, now that the powers that be are finally listening to us, all you got to do is make the right argument and we'll start to see real change, or that's how the logic goes. I think that's not just a meshing of political approaches, but it's a meshing of practice as well. So part of the agenda that the ruling class is putting forward is to organise, like, actual summits, actual panels, inquiries, commissions, all those sorts of things. And each of them, carefully designed to avoid real social change, offers a seat at the table not just to the NGO world in general, but to specific NGO bureaucrats, specific change makers and reps and so on, who get to sit there and be the important person at the table. And so, you know, for a select handful of SS4C members, there was seats at the UN in Geneva to go and make your case about the climate crisis. You know, learn how to be a future leader of society. You know, some of them have got book deals, television appearances. They get to be an anointed person. And I think, needless to say, the life of a radical committed to abolishing the profit motive, destroying one of the biggest industries in the entire capitalist system, should not actually look like that. And I think the impact that that has on people day to day is that it doesn't harden you up against the ruling class. It doesn't harden you up against the halls of power. It makes you soft on them. And so these people become increasingly detached from the world that they might have come from, the kind of mass rallies and stuff like that that might have given school strikes some legitimacy in the first place. I think another way that greenwashing meshes with the NGO approach is the attempt by the ruling class to paint pro-fossil fuel legislation as somehow green, which is totally emblematic of the Albanese government's approach, which is to give the appearance of reforms, to reinforce the idea that capitalism is somehow fixing itself, while in the meantime, the fossil fuel industry expands weakly. And I think the strategy of working in those institutions and then being at pains to dress it up as progress actually tends to reinforce those lies rather than expose them. And so, you know, rather than admitting that the whole system is bullshit, that you've been wrong, that everything was like a total farce from the outset, I think there's a serious pressure for an NGO activist to portray the outcome of a summit that they've gone and attended as in some way progress, if, of course, it's not enough. I think the argument that just think of how bad it would have been if I wasn't there is commonly used as a justification. But that's a broken logic because it means that you tend to dress up things that are by design greenwashing as victories, which I think also justifies continued participation in them in the minds of those people. And although this guy's conclusions are simply to accept it as an inevitable fact of life of political organising, this conundrum is something that a high-profile environmental NGO strategist called Laurent Mermet recognised as a consequence of appealing to power. So I read a bunch of his essays. They're fucking fascinating. He said, environmental NGOs tend as a result of that practice to be stuck between attacks on a limited group of actors with a bad public image, e.g. Monsanto bashing, or adopting cooperative language with other actors who may have no actual intention to cooperate. So they can understand the conundrum that they're in. They just can't solve it. And so what that looks like in Australia is that the Labor government has got away with the endorsement of not only the Greens, but every single environmental NGO in the country for both their 43% climate target and their safeguard mechanism. That is the political consequence of this practice. That is a huge political victory for a party that is committed to coal and gas and to the mining bosses as well. So the Minerals Council CEO, Tanya Constable, who I actually think is a better metric of whether the fossil fuel industry is being hurt than what the Greens claim is going to happen, she said of the safeguard bill, there will be very little change for the mining industry as a result. Some victory, yeah. And so understanding that the powers that be will never agree to voluntarily give up power and profits associated with fossil fuels is really important. Sitting in the halls of power, at summits, conferences and so on, attempting to compel these people, you know, sometimes very earnestly to compel these people, does nothing but waste valuable energy and effort. Constantly trying to extol the virtues of and participate in partnerships where your supposed partners destroy the planet is a total contradiction that just rubber stamps the ruling class's strategy of greenwashing. I think A recognition of the sort of swindle that's going on with the greenwashing moment is what led Greta Thunberg to boycott last year's COP27 summit in Cairo. She argued that the COPs are mainly used as an opportunity for leaders and people in power to get attention using many different kinds of greenwashing, and that the summits are not really meant to change the whole system, but instead promote reasonable, i.e. meaningless, progress. Her stance was important because it openly rejected the idea that to make change, you have to participate in and accept the structures of power that the ruling class is putting forward. On the thing of, like, dressing up absolute shit, it's like, as progress. I think it was Martin Luther King was fond of saying during the civil rights movement, if you shove a dagger in my back 6 inches and pull it out 3, it's not progress. I think that should be our yardstick for measuring what isn't a reform. And every single reform that's ever been won, not just environmental reforms, but around any social issue, has taken struggle. There's not actually all of this radical protest going on around the environment movement. So we shouldn't expect anything that's doled out by the ruling class to be these, like, wonderful reforms. I think it will take struggle. And the mining industry will be against the reforms that are put in against them. They won't say, wow, this has really shored up the future of our profitability. Now we can make sensible decisions based on the stability that the Labour Party has ensured. It's like, that won't be. Maybe I should get a job as a mining PR spokesman. But, like, that won't be the political landscape when a real reform is being fought for. And I think just on one thing that's come up, like, I think we should be careful not to, like, point at the funding avenues as the, like, gotcha for why they act in this terrible way, because Friends of the Earth, like, they actually disclose all of their, like, donations and stuff like that. They're very clear about not taking big corporate donations. They say, like, of course, we don't want to be beholden to corporate interests. That's what the ACF does. But they still do the exact same thing. So it's something more deep about their project that makes them act in this way, which is functionally the exact same. And I think one thing is that I don't think that they're all these people in, like, Friends of the Earth. I mean, some of them are a bit cynical and, like, you know, get to see how they operate and stuff like that. And they are operators, that's for sure. But I think the more genuinely you think what you're doing is justified, the better salesman you are. So it's not just that they all, like, I love the fossil fuel industry secretly. It's that they really believe that what they're doing is making change. But that makes them, like, ever the more difficult to pin down, because if you have a politics which is based on, but these people really care, you can't actually unpack the problems with their politics. So we have to be able to see beneath the kind of, oh, but these people care about the climate, you care about the climate, why are you being so mean to each other, which definitely comes up in the movements, and understand there's actually something deeper than just the motivations of individuals to act in a certain way that makes their political practice so destructive. So I'll leave it there.
And you're with Annie on Solidarity Breakfast, and we were just listening to a speech that Jack Mansell made at the Marxist Conference, and it was entitled NGOs Getting Paid to Preserve the System.